Thank you. We must say it's really, well, this is the second time we've been here, and I think we had more nerves the second time than the first. I know I did. Is this something from Led Zeppelin 2?
Right.
This is a thing. This is a thing called Heartbreaker.
Welcome back, Led Zeppelin enthusiasts, to another riveting episode of the All Things Led Zeppelin podcast, ZepFan. This is episode 15, and we're thrilled to have you tuning in once again. Today's episode is an absolute treat, as we have not one, but two extraordinary guests, both icons in the Led Zeppelin community. They are here to share the wealth of information they've uncovered about these two incredible concert films from 1970. Before we dive into the conversation, we kindly ask you to take a moment and rate our podcast. Your feedback is invaluable, and it helps us improve and grow. You can find our podcast on all the popular podcast networks, so be sure to subscribe and stay updated with our latest episodes. For all you Led Zeppelin memorabilia enthusiasts out there, we have something special for you. Visit ZepFan.com. It's a memorabilia-enriched website featuring over 6,000 Led Zeppelin items. It's the most extensive Led Zeppelin memorabilia database on the internet, and you're bound to be amazed by the collection. If you ever need to get in touch with me, Mark McFall, feel free to reach out at contact@ZepFan.com. With that said, all that's out of the way, let's dive straight into the captivating world of Led Zeppelin on film. Let's roll. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an absolute pleasure to have you listen to today's episode as we welcome back a distinguished guest for the third time, the one and only James Cook. As many of you know, James is the brilliant mind behind Led Zepp News website, which always offers us a treasure trove of information. Recently, James treated us to an incredible in-depth story revolving around two iconic concert films from 1970. The recently surfaced Bath Festival and the iconic Royal Albert Hall performance. To maximize the story's potential, he joined forces with none other than Eric Levy, well known for his knowledge of Led Zeppelin videos. Today's focus is one of my all-time favorite subjects, Led Zeppelin video. So buckle up as we have a treasure trove of information to dive into. So without further ado, let's get right into it and extend a warm welcome back to the podcast, James and Eric. How are you two doing today?
We're doing good. Eric and I have never actually spoken like properly before. We've like messaged each other on Discord. I think there was one night I was like up until 4 a.m. messaging Eric, which sounds about the story. Very unhealthy. So my wife was very happy. She's like, what the hell are you doing all night?
What are you talking to some kid in Virginia about Led Zeppelin for?
That's awesome. And that's technology now today. You go without speaking to anyone or seeing anybody and get everything accomplished.
Yeah, so we spent weeks sort of talking about this article and sort of hashing it out together. So now it's out in the world. We can breathe a deep breath and sort of talk through some things there. So thank you for having us on, Mark.
Right.
Yes, please. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, definitely. And thanks again, James, for sharing this story with me. I know you reached out to me last week and told me about it, and you'd say, hey, this would be a great podcast. So like the last episode that we did, it's like, thank you for keeping in mind, because I always think that the articles are amazing, but sometimes it's fun to talk it out as well, because people like to hear that as well. It's kind of like the audiobook version of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think for us, you know, we spent so long doing, and between Eric and I, we've been sort of super excited about, you know, I've interviewed this person or whatever. So to be able to sort of talk through how it came together and, you know, what was cut out or what we would have liked to put in, that's kind of fun to sort of go under the hood there. So, yeah.
It's a delight to have you back to the podcast, as always, as I just mentioned. And this marks your impressive third appearance. So you practically become a regular guest. So you deserve your own virtual desk and chair over here in the corner.
One day.
Before we dive into the specifics, could you share with us the genesis of this incredible story? How did it all come about? And what juncture did you decide to bring Eric on board for this project?
Yeah, so it all started in a typical journalist way. It was a sunny day in 2017, and there was a screening of the Royal Albert Hall 1970 footage inside the Royal Albert Hall. There were some sort of event rooms there, and there was a panel about Peter Whitehead's footage. And I thought, well, I'll go along, not expecting there to be any revelations. I thought it's kind of cool to see the footage in the building it was filmed. And speaking on this panel was Julie Felix, it was amazing, it was before she died, and a man named Steve Chibnall, who was a professor at De Montfort University here in the UK. And he sort of very casually mentions during this panel about Peter Whitehead's footage that the Bath footage, long thought to be irrecoverable, too dark.
Right.
He's like, I've seen it. There's 20 to 30 minutes of it. It's color. You can see it. And I remember Dave Lewis was in the audience, and I was in the audience, and our jaws just sort of dropped, right?
Because probably decades, hear it inside there. I think
right. For decades, that's how it was, and you know, we sort of ran that story, and that came out, and I basically emailed Steve and probably annoyed him. Actually, I filed a legal request to see these documents in Peter Whitehead's archive, and had this sort of mountain of stuff come through, which I'm not a video expert. I don't understand how film works. I knew Eric was, so I messaged him like, I really need your help because I can't make head or tails of this.
Yeah, definitely. So Eric, I mean, I could only imagine the excitement you had when James approached you for this collaboration. Considering your deep passion for Led Zeppelin video, what were your initial thoughts when you first heard about this project?
Yeah, well, I remember when James reached out, because we had been talking for several years, and James will kind of tell me, hey, here's what's going on. Here's what I'm finding out about becoming Led Zeppelin. That's what we really started kind of bonding over, because we were both frustrated about the documentary wasn't coming out. And James kept snooping around and finding things. He found the Apollo title and the stuff you guys went through on the last episode he was on. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to file a Freedom of Information Act to try and get the stuff that's in Peter Whitehead's archive, because the university is a public institution. I can do it. I was like, dude, why not? Let's get this done. Let's see what we can find out. Because James, and correct me if I'm wrong, you called Steve recently and he was telling you like, hey, we have, you know, the transcripts of Peter Whitehead's witness statement at the high court trial. We have the sheets of when the film was developed, you know, all the instructions and all the reels that were on there. And, you know, there was correspondence involving a documentary being made. And when I heard that, I was like, wow, like this could finally answer the questions that we've had for so long. Because, and Mark, I don't know what you've heard over the years, but I feel like the impression I got was, all right, Led Zeppelin hired Peter Whitehead to film the Royal Albert Hall for a television special of sorts. And there were rumors forever that he followed them on their American tour and then culminated at the Bath Festival. And we knew that the Royal Albert Hall was filmed, and we knew that the Bath Festival was filmed. We just didn't know the extent or the purpose exactly, other than documentary. So when we got these documents, and as James started interviewing more and more people, we were like, wow, like this story has been twisted, as the rumor mill does. And soon to find out that Peter Whitehead was sort of a very charismatic, exaggerating character whenever he spoke. And secondly, that there wasn't really plans for a documentary to begin with. And it was funny because I posted the article to Royal Orleans, and a lot of people laughed at the fact that Stanley Dorfman had asked Peter Whitehead to film Led Zeppelin just because they wanted to see each other. And somebody had said, oh, they could have just had Peter Grant grab a couple 8mm cameras and record a soundboard, and that could have been it. But they went the full mile to get the recording truck and the cameras and then they were just going to sit on it.
Right.
For who knows how long, because they weren't planning to do anything. And I guess at some point Peter Whitehead had this fake impression. I don't know if it was a fake impression or just an impression that he was going to create a documentary. And then the Bath Festival happened, and here we are 52 years later.
Yeah, finally talking about it too.
Yes,
definitely. Well, so let's dive right into this then. Okay, we have the Royal Albert Hall, we have the Bath Festival. So we'll dive into Royal Albert Hall footage from January 9, 1971. For the most part, for a Zeppelin fan, you do know about this footage because it was on the Led Zeppelin DVD. As a fan myself, I remember the bootleg version circulating and the intriguing rumors from the 90s about it potentially being released for sale. Needless to say, it was finally released on the Led Zeppelin DVD from 2003. James, you've uncovered a wealth of information about the backstory of this remarkable film. So, I mean, take it away. Start from the beginning, Eric, dive into, but tell us about this fascinating journey behind this incredible piece of cinematography.
Yeah, so that film has been really special to me because that made me a Led Zeppelin fan. There was a sampler DVD that came with, I want to say, the Mothership box set. And I remember watching that thinking, this is astounding. So to be able to dive into that is great. For me, the most interesting interview was with Stanley Dorfman, who I quite rudely assumed was dead. Stanley Dorfman is very much alive. He's 95, he's in Los Angeles, and he's Exactly. So I called up Stanley Dorfman, which in itself is surreal. Like, he's this legendary producer, co-creator Top of the Pops. He basically hired Peter Whitehead to film the Royal Albert Hall show. And I said that, you know, Peter Whitehead claimed that was at the time for this big documentary. And he, Stanley on the phone, went, absolutely not. No, absolutely not. He was completely insistent. There was never any massive film. He was like, it's one night's filming. I was there, I directed it, I helped film a bit of it, we edited it, we sent it back to Peter Grant. That was it. He was very definite on that. So that was quite interesting. And then what Eric and I were able to do was sort of piece together with those documents the names of the cameramen, where they were in the film, cameras they used, things like that. So to be able to identify who did what on that night and then to speak to some of them as well was quite special.
How many cameras did they use for that night?
It was three cameras.
Three total. So I'll let you, Eric, sort of run through who did what, because that was really interesting to get into that.
Yeah, it was really cool because we knew that Peter Whitehead was filming and there was a man named, is it Ernest Vince? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, Ernie Vince, Vince? Yeah.
Yeah, Ernie Vince. Yeah, he went by Ernie. And Peter and Ernie, because on the DVD liner notes, Dick Caruthers mentions that it's two cameras, even though it's three, but it's mostly Peter and Ernie that were filming. And Ernie's the one in the pit. He's filming the big front row.
Right.
And I remember we were looking at the footage and we were trying to find the cameraman in the audience. We were trying to see like who it was. We didn't know who was what. And we saw this guy. There was a point where he looks the camera down and he looks over at the other cameraman between one of the songs. And we were like, okay, that can't be Peter Whitehead. Cause he has like a mustache and glasses. Right. And that's not Peter Whitehead. Peter Whitehead's the guy that's going around the stage. He's filming like behind Bonzo on the side of the stage. He's just the roving guy around. So it was mostly those two guys that were filming the majority of Royal Albert Hall. And from what we were able to find from Stanley Dorfman and a couple other sources, there was a third person who I keep forgetting the name. James, I'm sure you know who it is.
I believe it's an Anthony Stern, who was passed, but he was the sort of elusive third cameraman there. And it seems like Stanley may have shot a bit on that camera as well.
Yeah, it was like the two main guys filmed on, what's the name of the...
Eclair cameras.
Eclair cameras, yes. And then it was a Bolex camera that shot sort of, you know, wide shots around the venue. Like this is for the film nerds. If you watch Dazed and Confused, there's a point like near the end of the jam where you have the camera that's in front of the stage. You have the camera that's behind Bonzo. And there's a camera that's like way up behind.
Yeah, yeah.
The film's like down, kind of like the first shot of Song Remains the Same.
Yeah.
That's the third camera. And it wasn't very common that he was filming, but he was there. I'm sure it was just Anthony Stern and Peter Stanley Dorfman just swapping the camera.
So it's almost two cameras with that one intermixed occasionally, especially if it's just doing perimeters of Royal Albert Hall. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was really, really cool to be like, that's who filmed that shot and that's who that, and putting it all together was really, really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And we spoke to a guy named Ivan Strasberg, who I think I called him out, and he'd forgotten that he'd filmed Led Zeppelin in 1970. Jog his memory. He's now gone on to be a leading cinematographer, and he was the assistant to the cameraman that day. And he was basically shuffling back and forth with reels, keeping the cameras going. We spoke to a guy named Neville Crozier as well. He was in there on stage handling the recording of the audio for the band as well. So he sort of remembers being on stage behind John Bonham as well. So between all of those accounts, we could sort of figure out what was recorded, what the output was, and sort of what the band got from that night's filming, essentially.
Yeah, nice, nice. So how much time frame did they have to film? Like, did they put this in place a couple months before Royal Albert Hall?
Yeah, so it was late 1969, Peter Whitehead was hired, and he called up, I think, a company in London that had a few cameramen. He was like, look, I've been hired by Led Zeppelin. I need some bodies, basically. I need some cameras. I need some kit. He put together this team for that night. Ernie was not a super experienced cameraman. It was right at the start of his career. He's since gone on to do huge amounts of other things as a real sort of veteran guy, but it was first jobs really for a lot of them. Peter Whitehead put that team together late 1969, and then they went in that night, Royal Albert Hall in January.
Yeah,
yeah. It was a company called Document Films that he went to, and he asked them, hey, I need some cameramen for a night's filming, and that was it.
Yeah, at least they had more time than The Song Remains the Same. I think The Song Remains the Same. They got a week and a half to get ready for them.
It was Boston. Apparently it was Boston.
Go to July. Before. Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Okay, Peter films the Royal Albert Hall. Then what's entailed next? So the idea was, I think it's fascinating, though, you know, Zeppelin just wanted to see what they looked like. There was no intention to actually apparently release this. So what was the steps afterwards? So did Peter give the film to the band, or what happened next?
So there was an edit done of the Royal Albert Hall footage. Seems to be sort of a rough edit with some sort of rough soundtrack, not the soundboard, but whatever right. sort of audio Peter Whitehead had. And there was some sort of level of edit was done. It was handed to the band and they basically came back and said, hey, you know what, we don't love it. We're not super happy with it. We don't really like our performance there.
Right.
So then sort of Peter Whitehead has chats with them and said, well, maybe we do Bath Festival, you know, almost like a do-over. We do that one instead, or I come along to that. You know, at that point, Stanley Dorfman says that I wasn't involved. You know, he was the middleman. He wasn't part of this deal anymore. Peter Whitehead claims there was this budget for finishing this full documentary. Emphasis on claims there, which is the thing we sort of came upon with anything Peter Whitehead says, is you sort of have to raise a little eyebrow on it. So then Peter and Ernie, that same cameraman from Royal Albert Hall, off they go in their car to Bath Festival and then promptly get stuck in traffic and have a bit of a nightmare.
And I'm wondering, because you mentioned the talk of a documentary in US from 1970, because I think, I'm not sure if that came from a Life magazine interview, but that was always rumored too, but there was never any speculation of, or never any film of it either. And I wonder if Peter just somehow off the cuff mentioned it and it got picked up somehow.
It's very possible. One thing that didn't make it into the story, which I like, was I'm talking to Ivan Strasberg, who was the assistant at the Royal Albert Hall filming. He said Peter was a bit of a dilettante in that he felt he was more focused on collecting rare bird eggs than actually filming the bands and putting together these films. So it wouldn't surprise me if perhaps there was an opportunity, but he didn't really take them up on it.
And what about audio? Did they record the audio that night as well?
Yeah, so Royal Albert Hall, they had what eventually was one Pi mobile truck. They had two trucks that were hired by Led Zeppelin. It was part of the Pi Studios in London. They came, it's a guy named Vince and Neville. They arrived, they set up the cables. They had room under the stage to sort of handle the board, everything like that. The cables then go out into the truck. And Neville was up there on stage making sure that audio was being professionally recorded. So they spent, you know, considerable amounts of money hiring in this sort of recording van for that night's audio there. They really went to great lengths on that.
And the funny thing, too, is when we reached out to Neville, he barely even remembered that he did record Zeppelin. He's right. Kind of like Ivan. Because when he emailed James back, he was like, I did this stuff 50 years ago. I had no idea I'd have to remember it.
Yeah.
So he remembers being on stage and watching John Bonham stand on his drum set during Moby Dick, which clearly, if you watch the DVD, didn't happen. But he does stand on the drum set during Long Tall Sally when he's right. He's playing on the cymbals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he's probably remembering that moment. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the audio that was recorded, there was the Pi truck, which I think did The Who and a lot of other acts back in the day. So that was for Led Zeppelin, and that's what showed up on Coda, and that's what showed up on the DVD. And there was the BBC AM broadcast, which had like the second half of the show. And I know that circulated probably in the 80s, not the 70s.
Right.
And then there was the rough cut audio, which I suspect is like a stage recording. Maybe there was a tape recorder on stage that they used. And it's this very rough audio. It's the one that if you had the Royal Albert Hall rough cut back in the 90s or the early 2000s, like that was the audio that was on there.
Is that audio is what Peter recorded? Because from my understanding, Zeppelin recorded their soundboard, but they didn't give the soundboard to Peter to sync it. So there's two recordings, right? Am I understanding that correctly?
Okay. Yes. In his witness statement, Peter Whitehead claimed it was a sync. It was a pulse feed off the mixing board, which gives the impression of like cameras were connected to the audio and there was a sync pulse. But from what we know from the DVD editing was that there was not. That was not the case, or at least they didn't have a soundtrack to do that, and that they had to sync everything by eye for the DVD. So my thought was that since the audio sounds so rough, and it almost sounds like an audience recording,
right.
that maybe they had a tape recorder. Yeah, it had like a tape recorder on stage, and that was what was that they used to sync it up. And then hopefully, once they gave the band the edit, they would give them the soundtrack, but clearly that never happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like the most likely contender there. And as sort of Eric mentioned, that witness statement, Peter then goes on to say, and then Led Zeppelin had their own soundtrack. So I think he was suggesting that he had his own sort of audience recording just for the edit, basically, and had never got his hands on the professional quality one.
He edited it together, gave it to the band. What happened next? Band kind of just said, thank you, no thanks. We're not impressed with it. We're just going to
get
dealt from there.
Yeah, so after Royal Albert Hall, things seem to have just gotten a bit strained between Peter Whitehead and the band, because they came back and told him, or at least he claims, they weren't happy with their performance. It could have been they weren't happy with the edit. It could have been a number of reasons. Yeah. But they didn't give him the soundtrack. Basically, blocking him from doing anything with the footage. You know, he owned the footage, but they owned the audio. So it's a kind of difficult stalemate position. But that then went on to set up the Bath Festival filming a few months later.
After 1970, it gets shelved. They're not happy with it. Peter doesn't work with them anymore. Then it picks up in 1979, right?
Yes. So in 1979, apparently Peter Clifton is around. And I guess he had a friendship with Peter Whitehead. Is that right, James?
And yeah, I guess they'd come to know each other. Like, the London filmmaker scene in the 70s was still pretty small. And I think Peter Clifton sort of emerged out of nowhere and approached Peter Whitehead. He didn't really seem to have known him that well. So Peter Clifton seems to be in a sort of nexus of a lot of things happening here.
Yes. And Peter Clifton, we know from doing The Song Remains the Same, correct?
Yes. Yeah, okay. That's the same one. Yeah.
So I guess Peter Clifton had asked Peter Whitehead for a couple of minutes of the footage to use in something. I don't know if it was related to, because I know Jimmy was talking about like a live video chronology even back in the late 70s with what they had. Exactly, so maybe he asked Peter Clifton. This is just speculation. It's not anything substantiated, but maybe he asked Peter Clifton to, you know, hey, you know Peter Whitehead, hey, get the Royal Albert Hall footage for this or something. Peter Clifton likely gets a copy of that 42-minute rough cut and bootlegs it. Yeah. And that is likely how it got out in the early 80s. And I know, Mark, you did one of the first ever video syncs back in the early 80s with I Can't Quit You Baby and Coda.
That
showed up on a bootleg somewhere. And it was probably because of when Peter Clifton had leaked out the Albert Hall footage to bootleg. So this starts floating around in the 80s, and I'm sure Jimmy is well aware of it. And, you know, of course, collectors are eating it up because, oh my God, professional footage of Led Zeppelin in 1970. Right. This is unheard of. And I guess this jumps us to the early 1990s, where Peter Whitehead gets this sort of revival to say, hey, let's finish this. Let's, you know, work with the band and get this documentary made.
Yeah, so 79 happened, and I think that's a horrible time for Led Zeppelin to kind of focus on anything. I think it was just an idea, and then, you know, obviously things happened. And I remember the bootleg did come out, gosh, mid-80s. And I, you know, Japan wasn't a big scene back then, but I do remember it circling. But in true Zeppelin fashion, you get this video. It's finally Royal Albert Hall. You've always heard about it, and the sound is just horrible.
Horrendous.
Horrible. And the video is bad because back then you had PAL going to NTSC. So you had a transfer, and depending how good it is, you got Flickr. So yeah. And then I synced it up to the Coda release, We're Gonna Groove and I Can't Quit You. But yeah, I remember that very well, very well. Then we'll talk about that later too. But if I remember correctly, another version of Whole Lotta Love surfaced on either, I think, Australia TV too, but that's a different story. But yeah. Anyway, okay.
So say on Peter Clifton, who has passed and isn't here to sort of defend himself on the allegations of being a serial bootlegger. However, based on the balance of fact of multiple people we've spoken to, it seems that he was a real collector.
He also put out what's it called, Eric? The first cut.
The first. Was it him that put it out? Because I figured it was him as soon as
I'm assuming it was. So the first cut is the alternate take of Song Made the Same. That's about 35 minutes. Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
So I remember vividly walking into Tower Records, because that's what you did back in the day, and search all the magazines and search the videos. And sure enough, that was 1988, I believe. That was on the shelf. So it's like, what the heck is this? And it's funny because it's a blown out picture of Led Zeppelin on the front. You really can't even tell who it is, but yeah. I think it's Led Zeppelin, the first cut. So obviously he probably released that and made a buck off that too. So
yeah,
there's a story I heard somewhere, and I want to go to one of my books to hear where I heard it from. But I heard something about Led Zeppelin getting mad at the original Song Remains the Same director, Joe Masso. They accused him of stealing footage. And apparently it was for him to make like a gift to the band as like a thank you or something. Mm. And I'm wondering if Peter Clifton had something to do with that.
Right. Maybe they went after Joe thinking, you know, Peter would never do that. And Peter Clifton would never do that. And sure enough, he does.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's a sort of prevailing theme of a lot of this, is anyone involved in the filming of Led Zeppelin, like, stuff just sort of vanishes and gets distributed around the world and gets just sort of shoved in sheds for decades.
Right. And I think Zeppelin was always about ever onward. They never just stopped and focused on stuff. It's always about the live band. You know, that's why I'm sure they kind of regret not going filming more, especially looking back now, 50 years later. But you know, like, these projects, it sounded good, but then it's like, okay, let's just keep continuing, make the albums, go on tour. That's about it.
Yeah, yeah. But what we do know is that Peter Whitehead kept hold of that Royal Albert Hall footage. That wasn't sort of lost or put out into the world. Like, he did keep that with him because I think he realized the value of that. You know, he knew that was good footage and he made sure he knew where that was stored.
How many reels are we talking? What did he have?
So when it was up for auction, and Eric will correct me if I'm wrong here because Eric sort of flagged this. So in 1998, 11 reels go into auction there. The numbers I've heard are 11, 12, and 13 reels. Hmm. And Jimmy Page in 2003 says, I put this on the public record, so I'm able to say this. In 2003, Jimmy Page says one of the reels went missing, which may become relevant in time, but that was a quote in 2003 there.
Right. Okay. So where are we at now? So we have 1979, Peter Clifton gets in touch with Peter Whitehead. He gets a copy. Bootleg copies somehow surface, and that brings us to 1993. The Royal Albert Hall footage is brought to Led Zeppelin's attention. Who brings it to their attention?
So Peter Clifton had been doing some funny this guy. He pops up all the time. He was doing some private screenings at his home, and people were watching it. And there's this amazing woman named Jenny McPhee, who I spoke to, now has retired to Thailand. And I've tracked her down using, you know, investigative techniques. Right. And she very kindly came back to me. So she saw this footage screened by Peter Clifton and seemed, you know, it's low quality, it's bootleg, it's not great. She worked in the film archive business and decided, you know what, I'm going to try and do a deal here. She knew Peter Whitehead. So she spoke to Bill Kerbishley, who at the time was Jimmy Page and Robert Plant's manager, and says to him, look, we can do something here. You know, we've got this footage in good quality. She knew Peter Whitehead had it. Are you up for it? And at the time, this was sort of 93, 94, the answer was, yeah, 100%. You know, they had the bandwidth and the capacity. There was a deal on the table there that Jenny assembled. Peter was keen on it as well. We know there's a letter in his archive from 1994, February 94. He says, look, you know, we're in the weeds with Led Zeppelin. I want to sell it. I want to do the deal. You know, he's trying to get it done. He didn't like Peter Grant. You know, this was while Peter Grant was still alive. He wasn't a massive fan of him, but it was Bill Kerbishley who was handling these negotiations. But the steam sort of came out of that because, of course, Page and Plant go on tour and tour, you know, the world in 95, 96. And that sort of put a complete pause on all of the progress on that deal.
Well, what's interesting, too, is that we go back to Peter Whitehead's witness statement, and he likely fabricates this entire story where he meets Martin Baker, who is Jenny's husband at the time. And they sort of scheme, of course, leaving Jenny completely out of it for whatever reason, that, hey, we're going to make this film again. And, you know, we have this footage. And it's interesting that in the 94 letter, he mentions the Bath footage, which I'm sure we can go into a little bit later, but just something to keep in mind that he's like, let's work with Led Zeppelin. Let's get this out. And he talks about in his witness statement that he screened the footage for Jimmy Page in like the mid 90s, probably before the Page and Plant tour. And he mentions Jimmy was like crying and emotional and laughing, and like he saw Charlotte Martin, who was his ex-wife from the 70s and the 80s. And then I guess it made him emotional because supposedly they had just split up, which is clearly not true. Yeah. They split up in the early 80s. And he also talks about like a chance meeting with Jimmy at a pub in 1994, around the time that Willie Nelson was touring the UK. Like, I think we determined October, James, right?
Yeah. We spent some time reviewing Willie Nelson tour dates, as one does, in October 94.
Yeah. And he claims that, you know, him and Jimmy had a chance meeting there, and they talked about Peter Clifton, and Jimmy kind of been like, yeah, like I knew he was doing this around. So I'm sure by then, I'm sure Peter Clifton kind of had added himself, if that meeting even happened. But it's just interesting as we go deeper into the story and as we go deeper more into the present, Peter Whitehead, in his witness statement at the very least, decides to embellish things. Mm. And as we get into, you know, the trial and all that, he's clearly embellishing things to make Mark Hayward and himself rightful owners of the footage. So just something to keep in mind as you kind of go through these documents.
Right. So you spoke of Mark Hayward. So that kind of brings up the next topic. That brings us to 96. We're what, 36 years later? You know, this footage is still floating around. Peter Whitehead, what does he do with the footage? Nothing happens with Page and Plant and Zeppelin. He's not selling it. What's the next thing he does?
Yeah. So Peter Whitehead at the time was raising three daughters. So, you know, for those of us with children, they're drains on one's finances. And it's 96. Peter Whitehead's, you know, having heart attacks at this point. He's got three kids. Like, the guy needs cash. And, you know, Jenny and Bill Kerbishley, there's a deal on the table for, know, potentially up to £30,000 for Peter Whitehead, but it's 1996. He's worried he's dying, you know, at this point. So he does a deal with Mark Haywood, who he knew and had sold other footage to. Mark Haywood ran a memorabilia store, this real sort of Wheeler Dealer character, absolutely fascinating guy to speak to. So Peter sells the footage to Mark Haywood for very specifically £12,500. He potentially could have gotten more if he'd sold it to Led Zeppelin, but he wanted the money. He didn't know a deal was happening. So without telling Jenny, he does the deal with Mark Haywood. Jenny then calls up Bill Kerbishley, who's like, yep, let's do the deal. Let's sign the contracts. And then she finds out the footage has already been sold. She said this amazing thing, which is, I still remember where I was when I had that phone call. Like, that was still an emotional thing for her to learn that.
It's finally a done deal. And it's, wow.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then, so Mark ends up with the reels. Mm-hmm. Right. So he pursues Bill Kerbishley to try to pick up where everything was left off. So how was his experience with Bill Kerbishley trying to sell him?
Negative is in one word. And I had to very carefully word this section of the story in the final edit. So Mark goes in to meet Bill Kerbishley and the meeting does not go well. Right. Like, Bill Kerbishley has spent years trying to get this footage. Some other guy has turned up owning it and he's annoyed. So then lawyers get involved at that point. Right. You know, it becomes far more contentious. You know, Mark Haywood decides and seeks legal advice. And his lawyers say, well, look, we're at a stalemate. Nothing is happening. Led Zeppelin aren't budging. Let's see what we can do. Let's get stuff moving. And at that point, serendipitously, Channel 4, one of the public broadcasting channels in the UK, gets in touch with Mark Haywood here through the grapevine that he has the Royal Albert Hall footage. And he does a deal so that they can use a bit of it for a television program. Now, of course, you know, you've suddenly got Royal Albert Hall footage being screened on television in the UK.
Right.
Led Zeppelin are not happy. You know, they did not sign off on this. They send, you know, a legal threat to Mark Haywood saying, look, this isn't yours, is what they claim. They claim that that was their footage to control. And that then starts a very high stakes court battle. You know, this is not a provincial, small town, district thing. This is the High Court in the UK commercial division. Like, you're spending tens of thousands of pounds on lawyers. And Mark Haywood is worried at this point. You know, he's going
up against Led Zeppelin on this. So I would be worried.
He's absolutely terrified. So this court case is looming. It's coming down the line. Mark Haywood, you know, it's what's called a pre-trial hearing at this point. So they're in the room basically to figure out how this trial's going to go. What's the timeline going to be? Mark Haywood's passing a note to Led Zeppelin's lawyers saying, look, you know, we're 30 minutes away from things starting. Come on, let's do a deal. Still nothing. And the judge enters the room and basically makes a ruling that Mark Haywood's costs should be paid, which is a pretty clear indicator that the trial's going to go one way and it's not Led Zeppelin's way. Yep. And at that point, Led Zeppelin kind of have to do a deal because there's no point continuing with the trial at that point.
Right.
So a deal is done. Mark Haywood bought a lovely house in Sussex, which is where I'm from in England, with the proceeds of selling the footage to Led Zeppelin. They finally get around the table. Another gambit he'd had was putting the footage up for sale in Sotheby's, as we mentioned.
Yeah.
Because of the legal action, he had to pull it back out of the sale. Sotheby's confirmed that it was in the sale, and then it wasn't. And there was all this sort of wrangling in the 90s. But the outcome is, late 90s, the deal is done, and Led Zeppelin get in a room in 1999. I think it was June. We managed to find the exact date and time.
June 9th, 1999.
Cool. Right. 8:30 a.m. in the morning.
Going up an elevator into the film screening studio.
Exactly. So we know where this happened in great detail. And actually, since the story came out, Dave Lewis of Tight But Loose says that Mark Haywood called him on that day to tell him that it was happening. So Dave sort of makes a little cameo appearance there, which is quite fun.
Oh, that's incredible. My question is, how does this work out when it comes to ownership of these reels, right? I mean, how does it end up being Peter Whitehead's versus Zeppelin's? Because Zeppelin paid them to record it. What I mean, I know you guys aren't lawyers, but I mean, what is the idea behind it? Because obviously Led Zeppelin thought they were going to win. Mark was pretty sure that he has it, which obviously he won the court case. But I mean, how does that work out, actually?
Yeah.
You guys know.
Yeah, so typically what would be done and what is done now is when you start on these projects, you iron it out to begin with. But this was 1969. It was Stanley Dorfman on the phone. The assumption was, because Peter Whitehead crucially had done other work for Stanley Dorfman, he'd shot things for Top of the Pops, and he'd always had the same deal where Peter's film company, Lorimer Films, that was his middle name, Peter Lorimer Whitehead, they retained copyright, and he was out of pocket on the expenses that were reimbursed. But Peter Whitehead owned and controlled his own footage. Led Zeppelin obviously had their audio from the night. So when Peter Whitehead sold that footage to Mark Haywood, it becomes Mark Haywood's film. And the trial didn't conclude. There was no judgment, but it seemed to suggest that that was indeed the case. And it was Mark Heywood's footage to sell, not something that had to be reclaimed by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, you would think back then it was all done on a handshake too, very little paperwork. I don't know how much was, if you found any on contracts on that. But yeah, nowadays I'm sure there's a pile of contracts on ownership and everything. But
yeah, I mean,
so quick, just like this remains the same.
With the sale of the footage to Mark Heywood, Mark mentioned there was a lot of paperwork. There's the pay stubs from that night, Royal Albert Hall. It's presumed that Led Zeppelin now have that as part of that deal, but there seems to have been some documents there that have sort of vanished over time.
Right. Oh. 1999, Led Zeppelin view it. What are the next steps? What happens next? They buy the film. He buys a nice house in Sussex.
They open up the reels. They figure out, they have to go through this edit. And, you know, as Eric says, like the audio is not there. They've got to redo it from scratch. That's why it takes years to come out in 2003.
Led Zeppelin obtains the footage. Led Zeppelin DVDs released 2003. Led Zeppelin fans are happy. DVD has the Royal Albert Hall, has Earl's Court, has net worth. So is that the end of the story? Is that, are we good?
No.
What else is popping up?
No, it is not.
Wait, there's more.
There is more. Because, you know, 30 something years later, Stanley Dorfman is walking through a record store and he sees the DVD on the shelf and he goes, oh, this is cool, whatever. Oh, it has my Royal Albert Hall footage that I shot 33 years ago at this point. Oh, it's directed by Jimmy Page? No, I did that. So the liner notes didn't credit Peter Whitehead or Stanley Dorfman, obviously, because Led Zeppelin had ownership of the footage at this point. And I think Jimmy Page had a creative director credit that didn't make Stanley Dorfman happy. So he phones up Bill Kirbishley in 2003 being like, hey, can I get credit for this? Or like, why am I not credited for this? So on the liners now, he gets an advance of what, like 23,000? I don't know if it's dollars or pounds at that point. But then he gets a liner credit in the thing. So if you have a copy of the Led Zeppelin DVD after a certain point under the Royal Albert Hall, it says directed by Stanley Dorfman. But there are copies, and we were able to verify this through somebody on the Dogs of Doom Discord server who had access to an early copy of the DVD, that there was a version of the liners without the credit. So we were able to corroborate Stanley Dorfman's story.
Well, I would think those would be, there'd be more of the ones without him versus ones with him, because the initial printing, they would do a lot. So if there's a second press, and even if there was a second press, so who knows if their name got on there. Let's talk about a little bit about Royal Albert Hall footage. So we know, how long is the Led Zeppelin DVD, Eric? How much footage is on there?
Yeah, the Royal Albert Hall segment's like an hour 42, I think.
Not bad. Okay. So the hour 42, the bootleg version was about 42 minutes. And I'm wondering, you know, reading this article, I wonder if all the screening copies was that 42 minute version. If that
I
was,
I think it is.
Yeah, just kind of made the round and eventually ended up in collector's hands. So I'm wondering if that's the case.
I think it totally is. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, and I was going to mention this when we were talking about the court case, is that by 1998, Led Zeppelin had released Whole Lotta Love as a single in, was it in the UK? For the first time, they ever put out like a real single, and they made that music video for it, which had, I'm sure for you back in the day, Mark, seeing Royal Albert Hall, Nebworth, Earl's Court, this footage that, you know, now we take for granted, but it was showing up on the screen for the first time was like, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
But it had bits of the Royal Albert Hall in it, and all the bits that are in there are from that 42 minute rough cut. So it was clear that when they edited the footage back in 1970, that they gave a version back to Led Zeppelin, and they held on to that and were able to use it in the Whole Lotta Love documentary. And I'm wondering how much Mark Heywood had seen of that, considering he technically had ownership of the footage. So maybe when he put it on Channel 4 News in the UK, that maybe he sort of knew. But Led Zeppelin had the footage, and I'm sure that's what it was. You know, they made that 42 minute edit, and anybody who's seen it knows it's rough. Not even just in the audio, but it's like, it's weird. Like it's very, like it's like shot and then like two seconds of like random, like through the vent. It's like, what were you thinking?
Right.
And yeah, that was basically that. And then in terms of what's on the DVD for the Royal Albert Hall, it's most of the concert. They cut out a good bit of it. Like how many more times is missing some stuff because of copy? Because obviously Jimmy didn't want to pay the royalties. That's How I Write Mama and all that. And they're obviously cut songs that were performed. So obviously they performed Heartbreaker after Days Confused. And the audio runs about 2.5 minutes or maybe 3.5 minutes or 4 minutes, I think. And then it cuts. And it was because the tape had ran out. And I was really hoping that when James had talked to the guys at Vic Mobile, that they would have had a recollection of that. But it was 50 years ago, like, obviously, hey, you know, shit happens.
You get the job done. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So 42 minute version, the Led Zeppelin DVD version, then the Japan released, I think it was on Celebration Day, one of the labels came out with the, I think it was just single camera angles of Royal Albert Hall. And how long is that?
It's like 12 minutes. And it has those lovely early 2000s. Oh, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Those amazing, like the cracks like go on the screen and then it like explodes into the next shot. But I'm very curious where those come from, because that's like it's not like it's the rough cut. It's like the raw camera angles. So I wonder how much Mark Hayward or somebody was, you know, screening it, transferring it, and kind of here, bootleggers, here.
They're essentially single camera angles, and the quality's not that great, if I remember
correctly. No, it's terrible.
Terrible. Thank you, James and Eric. We're already like 45 minutes in just talking about Royal Albert Hall. So I think what we'll do is we'll end up doing a part two, if you guys don't mind coming back. Yeah,
sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Talking Zeppelin. I love it. Thank you again, listeners. We'll be back with the part two. We'll do Bath Festival. We'll dive into that, which is a phenomenal story as well. And we'll go from there. Any last words on this story? Anything that wasn't printed that you want to share with us, or any upcoming stories? So, James, first of all, thanks for these crazy stories that you're coming up with. First becoming Led Zeppelin, a week later, 2 weeks later, you have this coming out. So you're just killing us over here. So great job. But anything else coming up, or anything else you want to share?
I knew you'd ask this, so I put some notes on what I, because I had a letter from the FBI this week related to Led Zeppelin news. That was fun. Thankfully, a good letter, not a bad FBI letter. So that was good. I'm talking to one of the world's experts on international tax revenue in 1977 for a story. And I had some interesting emails for you this week from a gallery in London about what happened in 2018 with a Led Zeppelin exhibition. So lots of fun things on the way.
And Eric, anything new coming down the pipe that you could share with us?
No, there is stuff in the pipeline. I'm not going to reveal what it is out of respect to people that are all involved, but there are things definitely coming. I will say that. And that's the thing with Led Zeppelin. Like, it's always this journey of, you know, you have all these people that you talk to and, you know, you talk to them and they say, hey, I have this and I have that. And it's just a constant, you know, right, giving a little nudge, being like, hey, like, do you ever find that? Like, you're interested in getting it out there? It's just, I feel like even though Dogs of Doom hasn't done as much as we did a couple of years ago, I feel like the work never ends. I feel like I'm always
involved. But everyone's in motion, still doing their thing, hunting down stuff, trying to get tapes and stuff. And
video. Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, I just like staying involved in any way that I can.
Who doesn't?
So doing the story with James was awesome. And it's just those things that I feel like the Led Zeppelin hobby is like the epitome of the, once you're out, they pull you back in.
Dude, you don't have to tell me this. I'm 40 years in. So I get out for a couple of years. And next thing I'm doing something else, some other project. And now I'm doing podcasts and websites and all sorts of crazy stuff. So it never ends. I mean, it was collecting and doing videos and DVDs and, you know, syncing and doing all. I mean, it just never ends. You may take a break, but you come back.
Yeah, it is a tireless hobby.
Right.
And I absolutely love it.
Well, very cool. Well, thanks, guys, for joining me. And we'll talk to you soon. Well, thanks, James. Thanks, Eric, for joining us today for part one of this epic, incredible story and journey of this Led Zeppelin film or films. Part two, we look forward to having you back. I hope everyone joins us for that. We'll be diving into the Bath Festival footage. I don't know about you, but talking about this 30-year journey with this Royal Albert Hall film, I'm going to go pop in Led Zeppelin DVD. I think I'm going to watch I Can't Quit You or how many more times. I encourage you to do the same. Everyone have a good one. Rock out, listen to some Zeppelin. Good night.